Summer School, Wednesday, 19th August, 1987. Let us start today in an unusual way. Onward, Christian soldiers, marching as to war. Forward, Buddhist bhikkhus, walking to the light. Both Christian and Buddhist have their proper place and function in the world. The Christian sings, looking unto Jesus who is gone before. The Buddhist looks within where the Lord of compassion and wisdom sits endlessly patient. Self-sacrificing love is the instrument of victory for the Christian. The light of wisdom is the divinely healing power for the Buddhist. Let the Buddhist say hallelujah. Let the Christian answer sadhu, sadhu. Let the Hindu join in with Om Shanti, Shanti. And may all mankind enter that still silence which is the utter end of all dukkha. Then indeed, pure meditation begins. At one with transcendence, you are the selfless participator in creative action in eternity. This meditation has nothing to do with the dictionary meanings of meditation. All laid down verbal rituals, the different systems of meditation, are just words, patterns of thought confined to the mortal self, forms of intellectual and emotional pleasure which are more or less on a par with the pleasures of the senses. Nevertheless, one must go through it all, for without going through it and seeing it for what it is, we cannot put it aside with right wisdom, as the Buddha used to say. Or, because we have really seen for ourselves, declare that it is neti, neti, not this, not that, as that Yogeshwara Yajnavalkya, prince of yogis, declared. In the Latu Kikopama Sutta, the discourse on the simile of the quail, the Lord instructs the monk Udayin. The conversation leads on to the topic of happiness. The Lord points out, this comes in the Majjhima, first volume, 454 to 456, that whatever happiness arises in consequence of the five strands of sense pleasures, sight, hearing, touch, taste and smell, is a vile happiness, an un-Aryan happiness, not to be pursued, developed, made much of, but it is to be feared. He then says that the happiness derived from the jhanas, which is the happiness of renunciation, of aloofness from sense pleasures and from unskilled states of mind, the happiness of tranquility, of self-awakening should be pursued, developed, and made much of. This happiness is not to be feared. In this connection, it should be noted that modern research into the pleasure areas of the brain by Dr. H.J. Campbell shows how pleasure is necessary for bodily and mental health. An intelligent person will exercise nice discrimination in choosing his pleasures. The Lord then deals with each of the four jhanas and the four samapattis individually. He says to Udayan that a monk, aloof from sense pleasures and from unskilled states of mind, enters and abides in the first jhana, in which there is initial thought and discursive thought, born of unconcern with oneself, and which is rapturous and joyful. This rapture and joy is intellectual, not sensational and emotional. Your thinking leads you to new intellectual depths and insights, like new stars swimming into view when you look through a more powerful telescope. But the Lord tells Udayan that this is in the unstable, for discursive thought just goes on and on by itself. It flits from one thing to another. If you watch yourself carefully, you will discover that the brain never stops talking, even in sleep. All dreams center around the self. The absurdities and the impossibilities that occur in dreams, such as flying bodily through the air, are due to the fact that the normal controls of the waking state are off. Hence, the brain can say impossible things. After all, the organism is descended from the primates, and you know what monkeys are like. So the Lord says, this very initial and discursive thought that is not stopped there, that is in the first jhana, is in the unstable because it is constantly stirring and moving. By allaying initial and discursive thought, note the use of the word allaying, for in the holy life nothing is done by force, but gently, by letting it calm down. The monk enters and abides in the second jhana, which is rapturous and joyful, but devoid of brain chatter. For the first time, one enters that silence due to the stopping of the chatter by the brain. How do you stop brain chatter? You know what happens when strong gales blow. Leaves quiver and fall down, big branches sway and crack. Or, to take another simile, have you noticed your darling infant's baby chatter at bedtime babble down into sweet nothings and end in seraphic sleep? Physical causes end storms or produce sleep. Air pressures in equilibrium for storms, and the tiredness of the vigilance center in the brain for sleep. But to silence the chatter of the brain, observe it very carefully, without any reaction for or against it whatsoever. This is extremely arduous and needs constant practice and dispassion. The perfect rhythm of your breath will be established, the body will relax, and the whole psychophysical organism will be suffused with ease. Notably, there will be an awakening of consciousness and a clearer awareness and more intense knowingness of an actuality that is indescribable. This knowingness is different from the knowing consequent upon the functions of the senses and the synthesizing by the brain of all the sense impressions into meaningful thought patterns by means of language for the purpose of communication or any other use. In the jhanas and samapatis, you progressively take leave of materiality in consciousness. You may wonder and ask me, what does it feel like? It feels like nothing on earth. It is not an ecstasy. An ecstasy is a standing outside of yourself, a being beside or outside yourself. I can only say it is perhaps like being head over heels in love, completely identified with the beloved, but without the disquiet, the absurdities and stupidities in that deliciously mad kind of love. One may say it is the first touch of loving communion with transcendence in holistic consciousness. Transcendence not in the misguided sense of the wholly other, but in the meaning of the absolute all, which is simultaneously the void and the plenitude, the no thing and everything. The entry into deeper jhanas is not like steps on a ladder or a spatio-temporal movement of any sort. It may be compared to an electric light bulb which can stand any voltage without breaking. All that happens on increasing the voltage is that the light becomes brighter and brighter. So too, consciousness becomes intenser and intenser as an ever-increasingly concentrated knowingness of the actuality which is truth, indescribable in ordinary language. A 4-year-old will clearly understand that if he was given 2 chocolates at lunch and 2 more at tea, he has had 4 chocolates in all. But what can he possibly make of x equals hy plus g plus or minus the square root of hy plus g squared minus AFBY squared plus 2FY plus C, the whole expression divided by A, as the solution of the quadratic AX squared plus 2XHY plus G plus BY squared plus 2FY plus C equals naught. So too, the consciousness enclosed in the prison house of sense impressions and the conditioned brain cannot possibly know the freedom and truth which open up in the jhanas. The rapture and joy attending the jhanas is very peaceful and calm, quite unlike the thrilling rapture which flushes through you when you answer the doorbell and your sweetheart unexpectedly steps in with a "Hello, darling." The jhana rapture is even profounder than that which makes every wrinkle in my old face and brow curl into a smile when at last the sudden flash of insight fills consciousness, crowning a well-sustained attentiveness. Our inner consciousness is the mode in which we are aware of ourselves and the whole environment. It determines the nature and quality of our thinking, feeling, speaking, doing, which in turn affects our inner consciousness, our mode of awareness of existence. Attachment to the pleasant and aversion from the unpleasant is universal, but both of them teach us how to tread the way to freedom from all duality if we practice perfect mindfulness whilst experiencing either the pleasant or the unpleasant. The rapture and joy of the first two jhanas may incline us to stick in the sweet-scented mud of rapture. Not only whiskey, but also jhanic pleasure can be intoxicating. So, the Lord tells Udayan, bring it to its ending and transcend it. Thus, by the fading out of rapture, the monk dwells with equanimity, attentive and clearly conscious, and abides in the third jhana. Here too, the happiness, sukha, in equanimity, that is, not stopped there, is in the unstable. There is also present the complementary pole of dukkha. Remember the great truth. The path of a Buddha is filled with unutterable woe. For, as your consciousness grows towards holistic consciousness with proper spiritual development, you become increasingly sensitive and aware of the world woe, Weltschmerz. Again, the Buddha says, transcend it. And the monk, free of both sukha and dukkha, enters and abides in the fourth jhana, which is entirely purified by equanimity and mindfulness. This, says the Buddha to Udayan, is the stable. But even with respect to the fourth jhana, the Buddha says, this is not enough. Get free of it. Transcend it. And what is its transcending? Now, note very carefully what the Buddha says. As to this, Udayan, a monk, by wholly transcending perception of material shapes, by the going down of perception due to sensory impressions, by not attending to perceptions of variety, becoming conscious that akasha is unending, that monk enters and abides in the sphere of infinite akasha. This is very important. This is the crucial transition point. I'll repeat it. As to this, Udayan, a monk, by wholly transcending perception of material shapes by the going down of perception due to sensory impressions, by not attending to perceptions of variety, becoming conscious that akasha, it's usually translated with the old-fashioned word ether, is unending, that monk enters and abides in the sphere of infinite akasha. Note carefully, infinite akasha. This is the first samapatti. Now the word samapatti in the dictionary is usually translated as attainment. I think that's a very poor translation. Regard it more as a coalescence. The coalescence with infinity. You are no longer restricted to consciousness in terms of the finite and the temporal. Your consciousness coalesces with the totality, the manifested totality, because akasha deals with that. Here at last begins the entry into the context of infinity. You know, I've talked on previous occasions of the holistic consciousness functions in the context of infinity and eternity. All materiality, all dependence upon separate factors of conditionality, all measurability, which is characteristic of finitude, of limitation, of bondage, is surpassed. Surpassed meaning passed over. Passed over, but not rejected. For infinity or immeasurability cannot be itself unless it wholly subsumes finitude, limitation, and bondage. And unless there was a relationship, we could not release ourselves from the limitations of the finite and temporal and realize the infinite. Understand this, and we can understand that holistic consciousness, the consciousness of transcendence itself, rejects nothing whatsoever. So when a person asks you, why did God allow evil and all the rest of the nonsense, you see, just answer, God functions in terms of the holistic consciousness which functions in infinity and eternity. And therefore, God is infinitely patient and lets everything come to fruition in its own sweet time. Sometimes it doesn't, but it is not destroyed, therefore. One waits and waits till ultimately there is transformation, and that is fruition. The nature of that transformation cannot be put in terms of thought or concept and word. If it did, if it rejected anything, salvation in the true and complete sense would not be possible, and measureless compassion and wisdom, Mahakaruna and Mahaprajna, would lose their meaning. Again, the Buddha says, this is not enough. He was a greedy fellow. So the monk wholly transcends the sphere of infinite akasha. The common meanings of akasha are space and sky. Space as the container of all things, and also as the void which holds in potentiality and simultaneously is the generator of the plenitude. Modern science says matter is warped space. As the psycho-material origin of all manifestation, our psychical life of thought, feeling, of intellect, emotion comes within its compass. Its essence seems to be of pure mind, transparent and universal. It is an order of life energy which is non-finite and self-shining, Rochana Diva. The root of Akasha is Kash, meaning to shine. Compare Genesis 1:3, and God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Light shines and makes clear. Akasha is simultaneously a limitless void and a conditioned fullness. You have to meditate on these things a great deal to get the point. An order of being which, fecundated by transcendence, holds all the archetypal forms and energies, the shining angels and archangels, the devas, as they have been called, of all that is. Akasha is related to distance, measurement, and movement. Consciousness is related to time, to duration. We experience all this in terms of limitation. When the monk transcends the sphere of the infinity of Akasha, he enters upon and abides in the infinity of consciousness, which is eternity. This consciousness is not vijnana, our ordinary everyday consciousness, which is analytic, discriminative, separative, and isolative. This consciousness is what the Buddha called vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabam. It is unitarily whole consciousness, which is characterless, endless, and therefore beginningless, everywhere shining. In short, it is holistic consciousness. That phrase of the Buddha, vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabam, which means consciousness which is characterless, which is endless, shining everywhere. It's an extraordinary statement. A careful study of the Varaha Upanishad would be enlightening here. It may be suggested at this point, regard the Atma as the all-inclusive self-consciousness of Brahman, the one total reality. If Brahman were to use the word I, that is the meaning of Atma. Brahman is the totality. Atma also is the totality. That which is infinite and eternal, I mentioned this yesterday too, that which is infinite and eternal cannot be split up into little bits and a particular bit be appropriated by oneself. It is a mistake to talk in terms of my Atma or his divine spark or my divine spark. You can't split up the infinite and appropriate it. I think the legend of Lucifer aspiring to equality with the Almighty partly means that. And Lucifer didn't find great comfort in consequence. Holistic consciousness, functioning in the infinity of Akasha, knows neither here nor there, somewhere or anywhere. Infinity is the absolute here, the measureless point, and also the boundless open sphere. Eternity is not timelessness, I think this is one of the errors that all the mystics through the ages have made. Please, I'm not conceited about this, but think it out carefully. The experiencing of timelessness begins at a point in time and ends at a point in time. The Buddha himself declared for 7 nights and 7 days he could stay in this transcendent state. Timelessness, thus bounded by time, is the foreshadowing of eternity. In eternity, all of the past, the future, and the future and the are simultaneously there in the concentrated, immediate now, the ever-transforming present. Mystics have talked of the eternal now. But the eternal now does not mean that the now just continues forever and ever. In eternity, just as in infinity, in the real consciousness of those two, there is no continuity. Because continuity implies separateness and therefore measurability. These are immeasurable. These are the extraordinary things which happen through the development of consciousness. Movement spells limitation. Holistic consciousness knows no limitation. Space and time are simply the absolute here now, or now here, for the holistic consciousness of the perfected Holy One. Understanding this, we might see the meaning in the Buddha's saying that in a split second, like a strong man bending or putting out his arm, he is in the realm of the 33 gods, or that he foresees this, that, or the other. And then, of course, the various siddhis, as they are called, the mystic powers which you get. You can go through a wall, you can walk on water, and all the rest of it. That does not mean that you physically do walk on water or physically go through a wall. It is in consciousness that you go through all the so-called obstructions. No other way. Levitation is a matter of consciousness, not of physical levitation. Otherwise, if it were physical levitation, something material, it would be something which could be taught. What would happen to all the airlines in the world? In the holistic consciousness of the absolute here now, there is the realization of the no thing. The monk does not see himself as a particular self. He owns nothing whatsoever, bodily or mental. He has no sense of possession of his body. Reduced to his own nothingness is the Christian mystical phrase to describe this. Self-existence and all existence is as nothing, devoid of any objective reality. There is a looking, but no onlooker, the grin minus the cat. Even deeper, there is neither perception nor non-perception, culminating in the stopping of all perception and feeling. For perception and feeling, psychophysical or transcendental, imply the duality of perceiver and perceived. You know, in the Buddhist texts, they mention this state of neither consciousness nor unconsciousness. and the stopping of perception and feeling. But this perception and feeling spoken of at that stage is utterly different from perception and feeling which we here experience in the realm of the finite and the temporal. That is a transcendent perception and a transcendent feeling. The feeling is allied to Mahakaruna, the perception is allied to Mahaprajna. It is a knowing by being. I'll perhaps expand this a little bit afterwards. The Buddha's teaching is neither nihilistic nor eternalistic. Eternalistic means the opposite of time. But eternity is not the opposite of time, since it wholly subsumes time. Time is the shadow of eternity projected on the screen of existence by my separative, isolative consciousness of me as an objective self. Nihilism implies the actuality of material objectivity, which is denied or rejected by the nihilist. Nihilism is the rejection by the nihilist, and which, as modern quantum mechanics and field theory have clearly shown, is non-existent. You know, science has searched for the ultimate building blocks of the material universe. And science itself has declared quite unequivocally that there are no such building blocks. That the physical manifested universe has no objective reality. You can't see it, you can't taste it, smell it, you can't measure it, you can't deal with it. The subatomic world exists only as man's own thought. They are creations of man's mind. Heisenberg, Schrödinger, Einstein didn't say quite that, but Schrödinger, de Broglie, genes, Eddington, all of them have said this, that it is non-existent in our ordinary sense of existence in terms of the solid, liquid and gaseous states. Nor does it exist as what I call the material energies which science has discovered: electricity, magnetism, chemical energy, gravitational energy, and so on and so on. The Buddha was not any sort of ist, nor was he the promulgator of any ism. He was Dhammabhuta and Brahmabhuta. He was the truth embodied. Brahman, the totality, the transcendent reality embodied. He was the Samma Sambuddha. That is why we say, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasya.